it's time. Spurs unlikely bid for the treble in 1987. The Dutch light up the Euros in 88. And FC Start, a story behind escape to victory.
And it's no nay never. No nay never no more. Cause I'll stay a while to over. Forever and more. And it's no nay never. No nay never no more. Cause I'll stay.
So welcome to By Far the Greatest Team, a football podcast where football fans debate which is the greatest team of all time. Joining me as ever, Jamie Rooney. Hiya, Jamie. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Graham, on the road this week in Copenhagen, but happy to be with you.
And in the guest chair this week, we have Mario Tilney-Bassett. Is that correct pronunciation?
It is indeed. It is indeed, Graham. It is indeed. Thanks for having me on. Good to see you guys.
It's nice to have you here, Mario. Mario is a Spurs fan, and we'll be adding a bit of insight into one of our side's Spurs this week. Jamie, just before we get really dive into this week, last week you were after last week's Time Machine, you were maybe having second thoughts.
Yeah, I was. Mario, welcome. Great to have you, man. And just in case you haven't heard the pod before, at the end, what we do is we get into the time machine. We travel back to the team that we'd most like to see from the three that we've spoken about on the actual pod that week. So last week, we were all in unison. Scott, Graham and myself all went Brazil 1970, the idea of watching Brazil 1970. And our reasons were absolutely valid. But then I got thinking, because we had Wales 58, on last week, and I started thinking, well, maybe Wales 58 would be a better option to travel back, because then you'd get to see Pelé, who Wales played as a 17-year-old kid. You also get to see Johnny Childs for Wales, who was also one of the greatest players of all time. And as a bonus, I'd get to see Garrincha, that brilliant bandy-legged Brazilian who was an absolute superstar in the 62 World Cup and came through the 58 team with Pelé. So I think I got swept up in the emotion of Brazil 1970 last week and just went straight in. And then it was only kind of after a period of reflection, I realized that Wales 58 would have been probably a better way to spend my time in the time machine.
Pelé is a 17-year-old. It's kind of like seeing Owen and Rooney and Giggs at that, or Russell Beardsmore at that stage. Seeing a youngster before at their prime. I like that. That is quite a good logic.
Also, the three you've said, Owen, Rooney, and Giggs. You could have seen them as youngsters, and then also you wouldn't be aware of what they would do in later life, would you? So Giggs' reputation is tarnished. Rooney's reputation, I'm going to say tarnished. And Owen's reputation, have you seen those ads he did? Was it to promote Dubai?
Yes.
His wooden delivery? When they're all wunderkinds and Owen scored against Germany and he's celebrating and cheering, you can capture those moments and not know what they ended up like. Didn't Pelé for impotence products?
Yes,
he did for a while. Yeah,
so
I don't. Yeah, bless him. I don't think he's promoting too much these days. Bless him. Michael Owen. Here's a fact about Michael Owen I learned. He once said quite recently, I think it was in an interview maybe 5 or 6 years ago, he's never watched a movie in his whole life.
That's good.
I mean, is that possible? So Time Machine 58 Wales for me, I think, just to see Pelé and Garrincha.
Yeah. If I had my time machine, I'd go back to last week and get the correct play by James Graham that I thought I was doing quite clever name checking. It wasn't Enemies of the State as I thought it was, which I think that might have been a Benedict Cumberbatch TV drama a few years ago, but it's Best of Enemies.
Enemy of the State, that was a film with Will Smith, wasn't it?
Oh, it's Will Smith is an enemy. So that is the Will Smith one,
Enemy
isn't
of the
it?
State was Will Smith and Gene Hackman.
Yeah.
I don't think Michael Owens watched it.
Do you know what? Actually, while I was once you said that, I did wonder what films he's watched. You can actually find the list of films he's watched. But it's got winners like Cool Runnings and Seabiscuit.
That's how it should be.
So I also, those aren't good films. Those aren't good films.
Not only did I get the name of the play wrong, which is about two protagonists, I also got one of the protagonists wrong. This is more understandable. People know Gore Vidal. William Buckley, who was somebody I hadn't heard of before I went to see the play, was a 1960s, 70s conservative politician and I suppose flag waver. So it was William Buckley, but I said William Franklin, and I think I wonder how I had that name in my head, and I don't really know why, because William Franklin was the actor who used to do the shh, you know who, in the Schweppes ads. Now that is that hasn't been in my head, it hasn't been in anyone's head for 30 years. I think he used to be in the Benny Hill things as well, which is quite far removed from Best of Enemies. So so there we go. I guess we go in into this week. So first up, we are going with Spurs 1986-87. And on the one hand, this is a strange choice, you know. We're here to debate whether they, who's the greatest football team. And it's arguable, more than just arguable, that's not even the greatest Spurs team. They're one of the greatest football teams. We're ignoring the double winning team of 61 and classics like that. Why go for 86-87? It's a team I have a lot of fondness and a lot of love for. Partly because I think it was the surprise of them emerging as this, potential treble-winning team. They were, had an assault on League Cup, FA Cup, League Championship, and doing so under in a stylish way, which probably again was unexpected. They were the first team, as far as I can tell, in the UK at least, to play 4-5-1, a radical formation change, which we hadn't seen. It was David Pleat's first season at Spurs, in fact, almost his only season at Spurs, as it turned out. And he created a team that played, I think, almost the first type of football that wasn't 4-4-2 in English football. Does that sound right? Or at least in the modern day. Jamie, you're our tactical specialist. Is that a reasonable claim?
I'm going to defer this straight to Mario. He should have more of the insight on Tottenham 87 formation than I do.
I'm going to say, as a Spurs fan, I'm going to say that David Pleat did invent that or brought that to England. Yes. But only, I think, because you had Clive Allen up front, but also you had Nico Klassen, a fancy foreign import. From Liege, I think it was, and joining, we had Glenn Hoddle, and I think we would have had our Argentinians at that point. And you've got all this flair, and then you're all trying to support one man up front, so you don't have a strike partnership. And I'm going to say that, obviously, I'm biased, but I'm going to say that Pleat brought that to us. And in true Spurs way, you can make all the innovations, and yet somehow fail to win anything.
Oh, Spurs were still very much Spursy.
I'll talk about Spursy later.
They're very much Spursy.
I'll be honest. I hate that tag. And I've got friends who are Arsenal fans. Well, I've got friends who support all teams. And I hate the tag. And you can't help but feel it's come from this. I've never really asked them, why are we Spursy? Because then I'll just get a long list of why we're Spursy. But this does feel like the ultimate example of it. You're doing so well. There's so much going for you, and yet somehow you end up with nothing.
Yeah,
and it does feel like the very definition of it. But I remember as a kid, I was too young to go. I had my 81 FA Cup song that I'd listened to, and my Holston kit. but you know, I went to lots of Pox games, and even though we didn't win anything, it was still a joy going. And, you know, I think if I had been going as a, oh God, I've been very young at that point, I'd have loved it. And I do think perhaps that's what Spurs are about. Perhaps we're just about the memories rather than winning anything. I tell myself this anyway.
That Spurs team was fantastic to watch. As you say, they had Hoddle, they had Waddle, they had, you know, real kind of Klaassen on the other wing, Paul Allen, you know, lots of, I think Vinny Samways was just breaking into the side around that stage. Lots of creators, but really, the amazing thing is Clive Allen. 49 goals across that season, 33 in the league. Yeah. From a man, you know, from literally nowhere, I wasn't aware that he was, you know, he's clearly Finnish. He could clearly finish, but to finish to that level was extraordinary. And Clive Allen, Clive Allen is already an extraordinary, you know, it's a fascinating, but his career is fascinating. I had forgotten, of course, that Clive Allen was the first £1 million teenager as well. So Arsenal signed him for a million from QPR and didn't play him. He played no games for them. They swapped him for Kenny Sansom. So Kenny Sansom moved from Palace to replace as a straight swap. Clive Allen didn't play any games. There's no nobody seems to know why they got rid of him. There was some suggestion that I think some conspiracy theory that they QPR wouldn't sell him directly to Crystal Palace because of Terry Venables was, I think, back in charge there, and there was, so it was almost like a halfway house. The idea that good player though Kenny Sansom turned out to be, and you know, that a team would take a left back over a £1 million striker does seem quite strange, doesn't it? And there are not, you know, and sure enough, then he goes to join Palace, and then ultimately, I think back to QPR before Tottenham signed him. So, you know, and playing across all these London teams, but 49 goals, and he was prolific. Mario, you were a Spurs man watching at the time. Were you as surprised as I am that Clive Allen should have quite such a bumper year?
Well, there'd been no sort of buzz about him. Well, I can't remember there being any buzz. He wasn't, you know, if you were a kid now, you knew who Haaland was before he joined.
Yeah.
If you were a kid then, you'd have thrilled to sort of Thierry Henry. But Clive Allen, I can't remember having an Allen shirt. Hoddle and Waddle. Those I knew. The fact I talked about Nico Klaassen before, a fancy foreign signing. But Clive Allen, and I've seen him in Spurs quite a bit, and he's one of the sort of club hosts that will meet lots of fans and things like that. But he's a really, and alongside Mabbott as well, and Graham Roberts as well, because I've been to Spurs a few times. You'll meet some of the players, and it very much feels as though they've got a lot of this team employed by them doing sort of meet and greets with fans.
Mm.
But that was his season. That says it as well, all about Spurs. The idea that you've got this top draw striker and you're still not winning anything. The parallels are phenomenal with where we are now. And everyone rates you. But even then, Harry Kane, he's been good for several years. You know, right now he's a difference between us being good and mediocre. Whereas Clive Allen, I don't think, and I might be wrong, didn't come in on that level of buzz, didn't come in on that level of favour, exactly as you say. And even then, I don't think we weren't a club that spent a lot of money, even with Irving Scholar.
Mm.
So I don't think we paid a million for Clive Allen if he was a £1 million man to Arsenal.
No, not only did Clive Allen not come into much acclaim, he didn't leave to a huge amount of acclaim. He was there for 4 years, played 100 odd games, 60 goals, and, you know, really good record. Most of them in that season. But any ideas for the man who played for exclusively London clubs, QPR, Chelsea? Not QPR, I hadn't played Chelsea at that point. QPR, Palace, Arsenal, Tottenham. The obvious team that he left for, any runs? Oh, this is completely passing me by. Bordeaux. So he joined Bordeaux from Tottenham.
A bit of travel.
Yeah. Before,
well, I think the wheels came off after that season anyway, didn't they, for Spurs? I think, didn't David Pleat leave after that season anyway?
He did. David Pleat left.
I was going to say, it feels to me, I mean, 49 goals, I think it was 52 games as well, which
it's
is astonishing.
The next season.
And it's Cristiano Ronaldo and Messi levels that we're seeing and we've been seeing for the last 20 years. It's extraordinary. But just going back to your point of this before we get into David Pleat and his exit, how much you touched on the formation and this new formation of 4-5-1, and you had this incredible creativity behind him, Hoddle, Waddle and Ardiles. And I didn't have Hoddle and Waddle shirts, Mario, but I definitely had Hoddle and Waddle style hairstyles at that time.
Did you have Diamond Lights on 7-inch?
I think I probably did, but I didn't buy Hot Shot Tottenham, which was the cup final record. But you've got this incredible base of creativity behind him, and just how much of it was to just front Alan to it. Because I think you touched on Nico Klaassen. I don't think he joined until the January. I may be wrong on that.
Yeah, he's mid-season, wasn't he?
Second top.
Yeah,
he scored 11, and Chris Waddle scored 11, but after that, everyone else is in single figures. It's pretty much Clive Allen's, you have to say Clive Allen because there was another Alan, Paul Allen. I think there was one point in time where Crystal Palace had every player called Allen. It felt that way anyway. I'm sure that wasn't the case. But it just felt like the whole shape of the team was just geared towards this incredible striker who was in probably the golden season of his life.
Yeah, absolutely. He would have scored half their goals. And, you know, and it is incredible. You've got Glenn Hoddle in that team who you kind of, I mean, maybe probably never a prolific scorer, Hoddle himself, just a prolific scorer of unbelievable goals, which is like a different skill to have. But I mean, I think he scored 6 or 8 that season. You know, everything went through Clive Allen. And that was what was so radical about the shape of that team. And it was something genuinely different. You know, teams were totally perplexed about it. By it. It is extraordinary how quickly that team fell apart, not just during that season, but actually, you know, so that was Glenn Hoddle's last year before he went off playing abroad. I think he went to Monaco, so he started playing abroad. Clements left quite quickly. Richard Gough, who'd come in and was you know, really solid centre-back, and at the heart of it, he went to Rangers, which you know, right now it feels like a strange move given the great riches of the Premiership. But at the time, Rangers, you know, was probably on a par with Spurs in terms of the opportunities you get.
Rangers could offer European football at the time, whereby obviously Tottenham couldn't because the English teams were banned during that period,
and because they didn't win anything, obviously. But that's another. sorry, that was low. And obviously, David Pleat left. David Pleat left.
Why did he leave?
Well, I remember what the allegations were against him, but I'm not sure we should talk about those.
Non-footballing reasons, but driving slowly in a particular area.
Slowly by the side of, driving very slowly along the side of the pavement. Was it? But I don't think we should talk about that.
But he went on to become it's weird actually, for a very short spell as actual manager of Tottenham, he did become sort of a relative managerial legend in terms of his role at the club later. He had two spells as assistant. He's still very closely associated with that club.
He is, and he's another one as well. I've seen sort of appear at Spurs and things like that. And he is someone who, has managed to sort of do a lot of stuff with Spurs beyond his role there at that point.
Now, of course, it was the league, you know, the league is difficult to win. Tottenham finished third this year and, you know, gave it a real good go. They were right in the running right up until the end. But it's probably the cups in that year which were the kind of the closest. We'll talk about the FA Cup in a minute, which is, you know, probably the famous one. I hadn't realised that Tottenham were 1-0 up at half time in the two-legged League Cup semi-final against Arsenal. So we're 2-0 up overall, and I was reading there was that one of the things that apparently turned it for Arsenal was that I think they played one of the Spurs cup winning Wembley songs at half time. I think probably Ozzy's Going to Wembley or something.
That's right. Yeah. I've heard that story.
Might have riled Arsenal. And again, it's another memory of how different football was back then. That Arsenal got two goals back in the second half, so it finished 2-0. No away goals or anything like that. No extra time, no penalties. No, let's have a replay. So you've got replays of already a two-legged semi-final. You know, the extra games Spurs were playing by that treble chasing side.
Treble failing.
The size of squads you have, you look at the size squads that you have now, it's sort of manageable. But that was again in an era where, you know, they're very reliant on a set 11, you know, with people coming in or not. I mean, Clive Allen would have played virtually every one of those games, I suspect.
I think the games did build. Sorry, Mary, please. I was just going to say,
I think that is a really good point. I think it's easy to overlook that when you have such huge squads at the moment, when you've got, if you play any fantasy league, you know all about Pep Roulette, and yet you would have chased a treble with all of the replays. So three, and yes, okay, there's no Europe, but you've still got three different competitions pretty much playing the same team in and out, the same system. And it is extraordinary. And also when you think about advances in physios and health as well, they managed to keep those players still on the pitch as well. Now, some people will perhaps argue, oh, men were tougher then, but I'm not convinced of that. But that said, though, it's an impressive achievement. I don't necessarily have an answer how and how we've now squads have become so important. But also going back to your other point, though, Graham, I've also heard the same sort of thing, because the Arsenal manager at the time, because it was Arsenal that league final was against, was George Graham.
Yes.
I think we celebrated quite early, started playing Aussie's Dream over the tannoy, which just rubbed the Arsenal players up the wrong way. From what I've read, Graham had to do very, very little to get up the Arsenal players riled and up for it, to then not only sort of overcome their 2-0 lead, but then also do Spurs in the return fixture as well.
Mm.
So there's a lesson there about over-celebrating too early. But anyway, sorry, your original point was about squad rotation. I don't know how they do it, and it's a fine point.
I think
you're absolutely right to point this out, because it definitely would have an effect on the team in terms of like the playing staff, because I think in mid to late March, Tottenham were 14 points behind the leaders, Everton, at that point, which doesn't sound like they're in a title race, but they had five games in hand at that point. So the games are mounting up. The games are five games in hand. Yeah. So effectively win your five games, which they didn't. I think they failed to win three of their last four in that season as well. But which is, again, probably lends itself to the idea that the team were just, knackered. And, we can get to the cup final as well, an absolute classic of a cup final. But in there, that goes to extra time. And I just think it was a very long season for a small group of very talented and entertaining footballers.
I think that cup final against Coventry actually also embodies why this Tottenham side are a great side. Despite not winning it, it is one of the best. It's one of the most entertaining cup finals. It had everything. I think doesn't Clive Allen score after about a minute or something crazy like that? Obviously you've got the Gary Mabbott stuff. You have Keith Hampkins legendary diving header. You probably see that in a slightly less favourable light than I do, Mario. But I mean, that was an extraordinary header. And as a game, I remember that being, amongst the best cup finals, my most iconic cup finals of my childhood.
I remember it as being very, very painful. Before I moved to Buckinghamshire, I lived in North London. And the reason I was a Spurs fan is that 81 FA Cup, the whole street was all decked out. Everyone on the street was a Spurs fan. It felt like a I don't think I'm embellishing this memory, but it did feel as though everywhere there were blue and white flags, posters of the team everywhere. And, you know, it was all too easy for me to sort of pick Spurs in those formative years as my team forever. And then the 81 FA Cup we won with a replay. Now, that was entertaining because you had Ricky Villa doing his amazing little Maisie run in the replay. Now, that was an entertaining one. Whereas this one is just a heartbreaking one. You haven't won the League Cup. You're not going to win the league. Then this is Coventry. We should be able to do this. And I'm pretty sure, I think the winning goal came in of Gary Mabbutt's shin.
Yeah,
so, the deflection. So then we lose to an own goal. So to the non-fan, it might have been entertaining. To a Spurs fan, I found it absolutely heartbreaking and a real difference from what I'd seen just 3 years earlier.
Yes, it's wrenching.
That cup final is quite incredible. And you talk about the Ricky Villa as well, goal in 81, and what links the two of them is incredibly brilliant commentary from Don Motson, who we sadly lost recently. He said after the Coventry 3 Tottenham Cup final, that's the finest cup final I've ever had the pleasure to commentate on. And I think he was right. But you're right to talk about the game, because in terms of the ebb and flow, Allen after a minute, then Bennett equalises on the ninth. Then it's then I think Keith Houchin gives the lead to Coventry. Then Tottenham pull one back. I can't remember exactly. And then you get the Mabbutt own goal. But what happens in December is a precursor to that cup final. So in December, the 27th, Coventry City play Tottenham in the league and Coventry City win 4-3. It's a proper yo-yo game. And Coventry take the lead through Houchin. Allen equalises. Dave Bennett, who scores in the cup final, gives Coventry the lead. Allen equalises. Then Dave Bennett gives Coventry a 3-2 lead. It comes 3-3. And then Cyril Regis scores to make it 4-3. So you've already got an insight into how those teams are performing. And at the time, when Coventry won that game, they went level with Tottenham in the league on 35 points each on the 27th of December. But there are a couple of interesting facts about this game. Keith Houchin, who was prominent in the cup final and scored in this league game 4-3, was signed at the start of the season by Coventry from Scunthorpe United, who were playing in the fourth division, who Tottenham went on to play in the third round of the FA Cup as well. But also what I love about this is when Tottenham turned up to play in the cup final, and Mary, you've already alluded to that you had your shirt with the Holston on, which is quite remarkable, because not every Tottenham player in the cup final had a Holston on their shirt because of a mix-up with the kits. But the referee had deemed that in the league game in December that the Coventry blue and white and the Tottenham white were so similar that Tottenham had to play in their away kit. But Tottenham hadn't brought their away kit. So they ended up playing that game, which they lost 4-3, in Coventry City's away kit. So you got Coventry City kits playing each other in that game, which is incredible. I mean, you would never hear of anything happening like that.
There we go. Now you've got whole squads of players and kit men whose job is to do precisely that.
Well, at least
they didn't do shirts and skins.
That would be a disaster. Well, actually, not such a disaster at our age now, but not such then. But I've heard at Tottenham as well, they actually have a man who's responsible for just buying their Hugo Boss suits. Effectively, there's an individual who's employed at Tottenham that just brings in all the Hugo Boss stuff that the Tottenham players wear.
I did not know that Hugo Boss. They style the Nazi uniforms in the Second World War, though. I don't know if anyone knew that, though. But I'm not saying that Chris Hemsworth supports Nazis. He promotes Boss Bottled, but I'm just saying.
So Spurs 87, I think we've gone into enough depth on that. So we have a convoluted, or not that convoluted, but we make it convoluted ranking system. But we have five levels of greatness, five distinct levels. So which go from outstanding great at the top down to true great, down to touches of greatness, down to edges of greatness. And then the last of the lot, blinkered greatness. those who only our eyes see as great. And then then for those that really don't, we do have a bonus category, which we call not great, but without them, we wouldn't be where we are today. I don't think Tottenham fits into that category, but Jamie, where would you go? Where would you rank them?
A beautiful football team with beautiful players, with a beautiful kit, not all of them having sponsors on their shirts. With obviously, as we discussed, the manager who's tactically astute and playing to the strengths of the team. It feels still very Spursy to fail on three fronts and not actually win one of them. So I kind of think, I don't know, I think edge of greatness. And I feel that maybe I'm probably being a bit harsh there, but I'll start with edge of greatness and see where we get to.
Mario, where are you going?
Do you know what? Okay. Ultimately, we've talked about how this team did a lot. We had a lot of talent. We had foreign players. We had the 4-5-1 system. You had Hoddle and Waddle in their pomp. You also had a lot of... I didn't realise about how Coventry City had beat Spurs in the league. But there's other learnings there as well, because I remember Keith Birkinshaw left. And he'd left because... he felt that Spurs was becoming more business-minded. And what's amusing to me now as a Spurs fan, especially, when I saw earlier this week that there's going to be like a go-kart track underneath Spurs' stadium in the car park, Tottenham is increasingly becoming more of an experience than a football club. So it feels as though there's so many learnings from all this time ago that could be applied. So great and not winning anything. And all the time, as you'll know, many fans will be quick to point out, you may be great, but you haven't won anything. I fear I have to put this team on the edge of greatness. They'd have delivered great memories if you'd watched them. There was certainly drama. And there were so many things that have us talking today, so many things that are still relevant today. But the trouble is, from three possible chances, the team imploded, nothing happened, and that moment was gone. And it feels a bit like Potch rain. It feels like a beautiful thing that could never have survived. It didn't achieve its destiny. And maybe that's what it was always going to do, just reach the edge of greatness, just touch the sky and not quite reach space.
I think you're right. As we're doing these, we're becoming clearer on what is greatness and what it brings. I think you're right about the edge of greatness. But in this case, I don't think edge of greatness is a slur. I think actually sums up what they were. I mean, greatness is an unbelievable thing, and to be on the edge of it, and that they were on the edge. I think is actually, something to be semi-proud of, mostly because they really embodied being on the edge of greatness. They lived it right to the right to the very nth degree, coming so close and stumbling short. But definitely a team you wouldn't forget. So Spurs, edge of greatness. So Jamie, we are now going to go to 1988 and a team which... throughout its career, it's probably not won the tournaments that it should have, not achieved everything that it might have. But in 1988, things came good for the Dutch national team.
Yeah, the nearly men. In strange times in football history, I think, as well, whilst we were in a period where English teams had been banned because of the Heysel disaster, the Dutch and the Netherlands, they were having their own problems with hooliganism that was going on, and big rivalries. So it's an odd period, yet you've got this incredible collective that Rinus Michels is back from the 74 World Cup where the Netherlands had failed to beat West Germany. The Dutch hadn't been to a major tournament since 1980. So they've missed out on the three last major tournaments. But now they've got a bit of collective and they've got a bit of a new team. They've got four or five players in the squad that have just won the European Cup with PSV. They've got a couple of absolute superstars in Van Basten and Hullet, who are playing at AC Milan. Rijkaard would go and join them shortly after the Euros, after his fallout with Johan Cruyff at Ajax and spending a season in the wilderness. You've got the Koeman brothers, Ronald Koeman, the centre-back, who seems to be on the edge of the box, taking thunderbolt shots in every single showreel I've seen from that particular tournament. And then you've got this Ajax heart, Jan Wouters and Arnold Muren in the middle of this Dutch team. And it's all about the qualification into 88, and then it's all about 88. But it didn't all go to plan. There were things that went awry. It had the happy ending, but there were periods where it looked, again, it was going to be the nearly man story for the Dutch. But fortunately for them on this occasion, that wasn't the case, and they were able to get their first and today only major international trophy.
I think it's also another reminder of that. That, you know, it's a very iconic one. The kit is really iconic of that team. As you say, proper star quality in that team. Hullet, obviously, with the extraordinary level of it, but, you know, Van Basten, defenders who would actually go on to be, real stars as well. The one that I had forgotten about, and this, you know, when sometimes you, I had to double check that it couldn't be the same player. Arnold Muren, in my mind, he wasn't playing in that tournament. He must have been the Luka Modric of that era, because he was. Oh, so it was Muren and Tyson at Ipswich in 70. That's like a decade before, and Arnold Muren. Probably, to my mind, he was always sort of 28 to 30 when he started. How could he possibly still be in that team?
Yeah, he did have the touch of the old man about him, but I think
he was over 30. Is that old in those days?
Yeah. Yeah, that's really old.
For a footballer back then,
did he appear in Escape to Victory? Because most of the Ipswich team didn't they? Wasn't he Man United as well before Ajax?
He went to Manchester United, and he had a good spell there with Ron Atkinson. I think he definitely won the 83 FA Cup with United. I don't think he was around in 85. I think by that point he had moved on to Ajax. But yeah, I too remember him from that amazing Ipswich Town team. But yeah, I agree. He does seem to be been around forever, even though he probably wasn't.
I do
mark of the man's qualities.
I do assume, you know, when we're doing this podcast in, you know, 2050, and teams will start talking about the Croatia World Cup winning team in sort of 2026, which Luka Modric got the winning goal in, and people are going to, was he still playing then? There are players who defy time. As you say, it wasn't straightforward, wasn't it? Holland were quite fancied, and you know, I suppose that isn't a new thing. Dutch teams have been well fancied ahead of most tournaments, has almost been their biggest problem. But this one didn't get off to a good start, did it, Jamie?
No, they lost to the Soviet Union, and before that, they'd lost in a friendly to Bulgaria going into the tournament, and then they went into the group phase, where they were in a group with the Soviet Union, England, and the Republic of Ireland. The Republic of Ireland, Jack Charlton, is the first ever tournament that the Republic of Ireland had qualified and probably seen as the whipping boys, and that turned out not to be the case. But yeah, they lost to the Soviet Union to a rat's goal, 1-0 on the counter. Arenas Michels was calm afterwards. I think he'd been there, he'd seen it before, and just reminded his collective, and it was a strong group on and off the pitch, that, you know, there was two games and he had a plan and they were still very much in the tournament. And that turned out to be the case, because they went into the next game against England and a Van Basten hat-trick. Well, Van Basten actually didn't play in the first game against the Soviet Union. He was carrying a knock, and it was it was Willie won't he start, and he didn't, and but he did start against England in the second game, and he famously scored that hat trick against England.
Does that hat trick have the volley, the acute volley into the corner, or is that a different game?
That's the final.
That's the final.
Van Basten.
I do remember that. That England side was a bit of a horror show of an England team in fairness. In 88, I think did we draw with Republic of Ireland? I think that's probably the only part. So probably beating us wasn't that special. But I mean, it seems extraordinary to leave Van Basten out. But these things happen in finals, don't they? Michael Owen, of course, didn't start for England in the in Glenn Hoddle's first year. Paolo Rossi wasn't a starter for Italy ahead of the team, and I suppose Jeff Hurst for England, but that was for different reasons. But so having beaten England, the Netherlands then secure qualification.
No, they had to get a win against Ireland. A draw would have put them out. And going into that game, it was goalless with 10 minutes to go, and they got a late one to win. In that game as well, how Paul McGrath hasn't scored a header is incredible. I mean, the bullet header, it hits the bar, it bounces on the line, it almost stays on the line. It's got players around it. No one deflects it in when it looks like it should be deflected in. No one can poke it in for Ireland. And how it stays from not going beyond the goal line is quite incredible. So a bit of luck. They get the late one. They get the win they need. They go into the semi-finals. Just interested to get Mario's thoughts on this incredible Dutch team and whether he has any memories. So, you know, he was a sprightly Tottenham fan at this point. And can he remember anything about those amazing players, Van Basten and
I'm going to say, it's funny, we talked about nearly greatness, and you've covered off a lot of this. That team at that point was just a brilliant team. You know, we've talked about Hullet, Van Basten, Muren, the Koemans, Frank Rijkaard, and it remains the only time Netherlands have ever won a major sort of tournament. And also, you talked as well, Jamie, about how Coventry beat Spurs earlier in the season. And we talked together about the powers of the Soviet Union beating Netherlands. And then for the final, they're going to do it again. Now, this ended a little bit happily for the Netherlands. And I think, wasn't there an amazing wonder goal as well from Van Basten? I know you said there's been a few videos and things like that you were genning up before this. And so I remember it being just a wondrous team and like, wow, they're brilliant, they're brilliant, they're brilliant. And it was easy. It's always easy to like the Dutch, isn't it? Because they're the sort of lovable, friendly Europeans. Everyone wants to be, you know. I do think the Dutch are often people's second or third European team. What do you reckon? Is that a fair statement?
I've always loved them.
Yeah, we expect things from the Dutch. You know, total football never won anything in the '70s, but this was their chance. And I do think this is a team that did achieve greatness. And though it's interesting that, you know, it's the only tournament they won. They didn't. I think they went out quite quickly to West Germany when it was Italia 90. So it was very much that sort of you burn bright and then fizzle out. But that's what makes them great, I think.
When you look back at these, because, of course, what then surprised me. And I keep finding this with a lot of the stories we talk about are things which don't, you know. So the Euros, the last one went on for several months, and you won, and the World Cup goes on for even longer. The Euros was always a really, really difficult and small tournament. It was harder to win the Euros arguably than to win the World Cup. I think, you know, it's only an 8-team competition, isn't it? So the Dutch are already through to the semi-finals from that, and then when you think it is only, I was just looking at the top scorers in that tournament. Van Basten was the top scorer of five. Once he'd scored that hat trick in the second game, he could have only played that game and been the top scorer, because there were only two other players scored more than one goal in that tournament. So Rudy Voller and Ole Protasov of Russia were the only other players to score more than one goal in that tournament, other than Van Basten. And it does make you realise that strangeness of that tournament compared to current things. But it makes it, you know, proper elite football, doesn't it? But also means, you know, in a small tournament like that, you don't have long to find your feet. It's a testament to the calmness of Michaels, and, you know, especially given the Dutch's ability to implode, it's quite impressive that they held their nerve to go ahead and win that tournament.
It is true, because the Dutch do have a reputation for finding an argument in the calmest of places, and that they can implode. But there was a collective this time, and I think that's down to the experience of Rinus Michels. And you're right, they faced Germany, West Germany, as it was. And quite interestingly, this was the last European tournament, where West Germany, the Soviet Union, and Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia through qualification would have taken part, because it was shortly after this that Germany was unified, Russia dissolved into 15 countries, although in 20 years' time, we might be talking about them all being back together again, who knows. Yugoslavia split into 6 countries. So it was a very interesting time for football, as I mentioned earlier, with football history, because Europe is changing, the landscape of Europe is changing. And they face West Germany, the host, the favourite. They go a goal down, and they come from behind. Van Basten scores the winner, and they go to the final, where they beat the Soviet Union, and they score an incredible second goal from Marco Van Basten. We all know about that volley. Muren crosses the ball. It's got far too much weight on it. I remember reading Van Basten saying, I didn't have the energy to bring it down. I was just too tired. So I just thought I'd swing at it. And, you know, he's calculated all that in the nanosecond. He swung at it, and it's absolutely fired into the roof of the net. And the goalkeeper, Dazeev, he's one of the best in the world at the time, doesn't have a chance. But that was the second goal. And in the first half, they've gone one up through Ruud Gullit, a classic kind of Ruud Gullit power header. Which kind of brings me in to Mario. Didn't you spend some time with Ruud Gullit?
I did do a bit of work with Ruud Gullit. Well, because I'm a big personal fan of Ruud Gullit. Obviously, I'm sure you boys know he created the term "sexy football" in commentary. But I was doing some sports marketing work for Canon to support their sponsorship of Euro 2004, and Ruud was Canon's ambassador. I'd had the wonderful idea of using Canon kit, turning Ruud from player to photographer. And so I spent a few days with Ruud out in Portugal, which is where Euro 2004 was. Basically, he did do some match photography, photographed at England training session. Just before this session, I was actually checking, and if you search Getty Images, you'll still find photos that Ruud Gullit took as photographer when we met the England team in training, and that was the 2004 team with Rooney and Beckham, and I think the Wags were there. So it was a good time to be around, and I was working with Ruud doing his photography. But I was there with him for a while, and I think he liked me, because the night before I'd been out drinking when he rang me to see what the plan was, and so I had to go in a pub, I had to say, sorry, it's Ruud Gullit on the phone, and then go out and take his call. And I think Ruud was quite amused by the fact
that Ruud again.
I was out and I was going to get a plane the next day. I'm not taking it too seriously, Mary. Oh, no, I'm taking it seriously, Ruud. But we went out for lunch, and then I found that Ruud, one of his fitness secrets is he doesn't eat main courses, because the man loves desserts. When I was out with him, the amount of people who want to talk to him about what happened at Chelsea, we're getting stopped for people to take photos, to get autographs. But he didn't want to talk about football. He really, really didn't want to talk about football. And I kind of get it as well. He's there being paid to talk about football, give his views on the Euros. And what he doesn't want is a fanboy then talking to him about football. But over food, we found common ground, because I love football, but I also love food. And Ruud, I remember, skipped mains, and I think he may have had one, maybe two starters and desserts. And we had a very, very detailed conversation about desserts, favoured profiterole fillings, and and I liked his style. The idea of skipping main, just having a little nibble of your starter, going having a dessert. But you don't want to talk about football. But a very lovely, charming, engaging man, and also a good photographer. Thanks, of course, to Canon's kit. But anyway, but no,
always on the clock.
As long as you didn't talk about football with him. But the amount of people, what happened at Chelsea? And I'm not sure that's ever been talked about or announced or anyone's ever said about it. Because I do think when he was at Chelsea, he brought Vialli in, who I think passed away not so long ago, who would have had a role in bringing Zola in. And Glenn Hoddle, the ex-Spurs man, was manager there. And it felt like an exciting time with, again, sort of foreign talent. Spurs, obviously, being the link men there, with Hoddle bringing in Wood. But it did feel as though he was happy at Chelsea, that he was bringing the club success, and then Ken Bates got rid of him.
I mean, he's just an unbelievable... He was an unbelievable player to watch. He was a show... I mean, sexy foot. I'd forgotten that was the term that he created. And he kind of lived and embodied that when he was playing. And you know, that is... I think that is one of the things that is so good about this Dutch side winning, is that one of the iconic players winning a tournament and winning it, you know, almost in the style of their best player as well. It's not done in a it's difficult to imagine any Dutch side playing not with glorious style. I mean, obviously, I'm ignoring the hatchet job that took out Spain a few years ago. But that's another slightly less impressive World Cup final appearance. But I just think the style of the team is really impressive, and for Hullet to be recognised or to have, you know, a tournament under his belt just really underlines that.
It's fantastic for Rinus Michels as well, the manager, because literally 14 years previously, in the same city, in the same stadium, Munich, against the same opposition, but in a different tournament, had a fantastic collection of players playing a brand of football that we all know, a team that we will talk about another version on the pod. But fast forward 14 years later, and the ingredients are similar, but the players are different, and he gets to beat them in the semi-final and then go on and beat the Soviets in the final and get redemption for that first game.
I think it's what's interesting is that actually the final in many ways was the semi-final, wasn't it? The Germany game was, West Germany were by far the biggest side. They were the ones that, they were the favourites, they're the home nation. As you say, there's the history, the footballing history involved in that. So to beat them, and there are teams, some of them based in North London, who, having got quite a long way through the job, don't finish it off. But in fairness, they did. They did finish the job off against Russia, a really underwhelming Russia.
Soviet Union,
of course, is. Yeah, USSR, brilliant shirts, of course. Always enjoyed the shirts they had. So underwhelming were the Soviet Union that the team of the tournament, I was just looking at, has 11 players in them, which that in itself isn't a surprise. There's 11 players in them. Six are Dutch, no Soviet Union players in it at all. So six are Dutch, only one German, Lothar Matthäus makes it. Six Dutch and four Italians make the list. No one from the Soviet Union. And I'm going to read that team out, because it is an extraordinary sounding side. I mean, this team's playing 4-3-3, and I'm going to go from front to back, because the front three, Vialli, Hullet and Van Basten. That's pretty tidy, isn't it?
Wow.
Midfielders, Matthäus, Jan Wouters from Holland, and Giuseppe Gianni from Italy. Now, for a back four, Bergomi, Maldini, Koeman, and Rijkaard. This is decent, isn't it? And so all you need is a top keeper to finish it off. Hans van Breukelen, is he the one?
Hans van Breukelen, he is the one. He's the one that gave away the penalty in the final, the goalkeeper. And it's, I mean, if you watch it, he comes charging out of his box to chase the ball down that's going nowhere, which he does get a hand to, but he takes the player out. And then even to this day, pleads that it was a perfectly legit tackle and the referee was bonkers toward the penalty. I mean, it's a guy that just hasn't let go. So where are you going to rank him, Graham? Let's start with you on this one. Where are you putting the Netherlands 1988?
Yeah, I mean, for me, there's got so many elements it touches. It touches the legend quality in Hullet. It touches the legend quality in terms of the kit, brilliant kit. Always an important thing. There's a narrative around it, beating the Germans, and you know you have some sensational players, genuinely world class players. I think the only thing that probably kind of lets it was a brief snapshot, you know, like a shooting star that just temporarily lights up. You know, there was no long term legacy. You can't point to tournaments afterwards. You know, I think the next thing I remember about that team was Frank Rijkaard and Rudy Voll's spitting match in that Germany game. So for me, it can't hit the one of the greats, but I think they've won one of the hardest tournaments there. For me, true great. What about you, Mario?
I would go with true great because while Spurs didn't win anything, so pushing up the edge of greatness, and the 74 Dutch team didn't win anything, despite creating sort of total football. But these guys did win something. The fact that they never won again, the fact that they never reach those heights again, to me, just adds the story of their greatness. So I also have to go true great.
Jamie, can you be tempted, or are you going to argue against?
I kind of thought you guys were going to go for one of the greatest, and then I was going to argue that maybe they are just a true great. But I kind of landed in true great as well. And you talked about the legacy, both of you, and it's interesting because the Dutch did go on and qualified after this tournament in 88. They qualified for every single tournament right up until 2000 Euros, which they hosted, which I think was seven in a row, which is still to this day is the most that they've qualified. The Netherlands has qualified for consecutive tournaments. They went out to West Germany in the World Cup 2 years later. West Germany went on to win it, though. The Dutch went back and Rudy Voller had to wash his hair many times. They failed to defend their trophy 4 years later. Denmark famously beating them in the semi-finals on penalties. And then they've got a couple of World Cups where they've lost to Brazil in 94, who go on and win it, and the Brazil of 98, where France beat them in the final. But yeah, so touch of greatness, I think for me, there is a bit of a legacy, but not a great legacy. I always expect more from the Dutch, the Netherlands. I think it's a crime against football that they've never won the World Cup, but it's their own fault that they've never won the World Cup.
it's a crime they continue to commit time and time again. Yeah, as you say, I mean, actually, relatively small nation with massive legacy and history of being great at this game, but not one of the greatest, but Netherlands 1988, true greats. Last up, we go with, a fascinating story, quite a dark story. I mean, not that much necessarily known for sure about this, but FC Start, a team that very few people will know very much about. Why should they be familiar to anyone, Jamie?
Well, first I'm going to take you back to 1981 and the Hollywood studios, and John Huston has produced a film with lots of big names, Michael Caine and Sylvester Stallone, but a host of bigger names John Walk, yeah. People that you know quite well and famously, like Pelé, Ozzy Ardiles. but you don't normally see them on the silver screen. And they were on the silver screen in one of probably every football fan's favourite film, Escape to Victory. And the reason I'm taking you back to 81 is because the legacy of the team we're going to talk about, FC Start from 1942, was the inspiration to that film. And the reason why they were the inspiration to that film is, if we go back to... back 40 years earlier, 1941, it's June, Hitler has authorized an operation to invade the Soviet Union, as it was in the time. They're going into what we know as Ukraine. He's violated a pact where there was an agreement that the two countries would effectively have a non-aggressive agreement. Hitler had a bit of a reputation for not honoring those things, and he was on a bit of a journey. So by September 1941, you're just talking a few months later, Kiev is completely occupied by the Nazis. And then this is where the propaganda machine is kind of taken into place, into flight. So the Nazis, as we know, are famous, you know, in terms of, you know, their propaganda through the Second World War. And they want to put a spin on Kiev being a city of prosperous life. You know, it's not all doom and gloom. You know, we've got these occupiers here, but, you know, it's not that bad. We're actually quite, you know, we're quite nice, really. We're letting you organize sporting events. And that's exactly what they did. So some of the players that were playing for Dynamo Kiev and Lokomotiv Kiev at the time were stationed in a bakery. Obviously, professional sport is finished. So these guys that would normally be playing football for a living, that's been paused. Which quite funny is what Michael Caine says as well in the Escape to Victory, when the German officer says to him, "It's a shame the war has ended your career." And Michael Caine, looking around about 95 kilos, says, "Just nearly paused." So that's ambition.
Can we? I've always thought this is. So, there are some plotline difficulties with Escape to Victory, but surely the biggest one of them is that former professional footballer and manager Michael Caine, who presumably was still, is his character is meant to still be, have some level of football fitness, is not only clearly overweight for a professional athlete, but this is after being in a prisoner of war camp. He's actually put on weight. Despite having been in a prisoner of war camp. I mean, that's something. I mean, what size was he before? He was the Steve Evans of international management. I've always kind of wondered, so how has this happened? That didn't the directors at one point think, shouldn't we cast someone who looks more likely as though they were once a professional footballer?
It is a great shout. But anyway, getting back to the realities of these guys that were originally playing for Dynamo and Lokomotiv Kiev, were working in this bakery, and they're basically making bread for the German soldiers, keep them hungry. And these guys are malnourished. They aren't looking 95 kilos like Michael Caine. They, you know, they are suffering the consequences of, you know, being under a captive. But they form a football team. And this is going on around the whole of Kiev, really. So it's not just FC Start that have formed a football team. There's a number of football teams being formed. Hungarian garrison teams are being formed. And because the Nazis are trying to promote this image of, you know, a prosperous life under Nazi control, they allow these games to take place, and they play each other. And FC Star effectively are smashing everyone they play. They're beating everyone they play. And then there's this team on the other side of the city that's being formed called Rust, which basically translates as movement, managed by a guy called Gregor Shevesov. Now, he founded the team movement, and he's trying to attract the Dynamo players to come and play for his team, because he can see that, you know, they're the key players. And if he has them in his team, then, you know, we'll be winning the game. So being organized. But the Dynamo players are a bit suspect of this guy. They think he's a collaborator with the Nazis, and they don't trust him. So they don't choose to go, and they end up stuffing Shevesov's team 7-2 in one of the games they've played. So FC Start are getting a bit of a reputation right now. So the Germans want to exercise their superiority. So they pull together a team. Under Hermann Goering's directive, some of the best German footballers at the time that are serving in the war. And Goering specifically says that these guys will not go to the front. He protects them from going to the front because he wants the team to look strong in the eyes of the Führer. And FC Start play this game against this German artillery team, and they beat them 5-1. So obviously this doesn't go down well with the Nazi narrative that, you know, they are the superior race. So a rematch is organized for 6 days later, and it's taken a bit more serious. And this is where the idea of the death match comes from, and the story of the death match being a myth. And the details of this match, albeit the score we know, once again, FC Start win 5-3. The details are a bit sketchy, and no one really can confirm the truth, because what's rumoured at the time is that it's refereed by an SS member. There are dogs around the touchline.
We've all had games which have been refereed by an SS member, surely.
But then there's also this story that came out of this game afterwards that if the Start players were to win, they would be shot immediately after the game. So they'd be executed immediately after the game. The truth is, it seems somewhat different. Now, there is some truth, I think, in that some of these players were sent to a concentration camp shortly after the game. And some of those players did suffer the fate of death 6 months afterwards. We know of at least three players that were killed, and but there's no real link to say they were executed and killed because they stuffed the Nazi team 5-3. So Russian propaganda takes course after the event, and they spin this into something that has become folklore. But what we do know is that the team did exist in incredibly dark times. Organized football was something that was able to take place in really difficult conditions. And we do know that this team, FC Start, would go on and win a number of games and also beat this German artillery team twice. Once potentially being told that they would be shot if they were to win.
Those bits we
do know.
Yeah, and what's clear is that there wasn't, you know, at the very least, there certainly wasn't the same happy ending that Hollywood came up with of the fans running on the pitch and shoulder arming the players to freedom. You know, the reality was altogether dark. I mean, it's as you say, it's extraordinary that level of being able to play football, things continuing during that time, but and the, you know, the circumstances in which you had sort of professional footballers almost kind of floating around looking for somewhere to play. It's, you know, unrecognisable from what any circumstances you can imagine, really.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really imagine, but I think it's the beauty of the game. It kind of wins no matter what. Even in like dire circumstances, you still want to kind of, you know, get involved in the beauty of the game. And it did thrive, and FC Start did have a small window of sunlight in what could have been unimaginable times.
So it's a sort of fascinating period, a really sort of dark period. The death match and everything that attached to that just shows, you know, the confusion of the time. And there's, you know, you get propaganda on both sides in one form or another. So FC Start create a real have a real legacy. So I suppose there's a escape to victory then brings it on to another level. You know, you've got the story attached to that, and you know, we probably would never know, you know, which is the more accurate portrayal of a wartime football story. The is escape to victory close to the FC Start story, or is the Paul McCartney Pipes of Peace video where they all play football at the World War One Christmas Day game, is that a more accurate portrayal? I don't know, but the escape to victory was an extraordinary film, extraordinary moment there. And I think what I found quite telling was a film of my childhood, and we talked about it. These cameos by Ipswich Town players. Do you remember who was the player who got his arm broken so that Sylvester Stallone could play in goal?
I was a goalkeeper. I think I do remember. Was it Kevin O'Callaghan?
It was Kevin O'Callaghan, the winger.
So and he wasn't the goalkeeper, really.
No. And that's
what. Did you mean that?
So what's curious about that? Which part of did Paul Cooper do the audition for it? And he said, "No, mate." You can't do it. You're good at saving penalties, but you can't do that.
I think they did have goalkeeping coaches working on it, though, didn't they? I'm pretty sure they had loads of football staff coaching them.
Yes.
Really? They probably needed it for Sylvester Stallone. Yeah, where do I stand at a corner kick? Where do I stand at Colby? Where do I stand at a corner kick? Colby.
Stallone would have been very hot at that point off of Rocky, though. Mm. I think that would have been the only reason he was cast, surely. And it's an underdog story. Which, of course, yeah. Rocky is.
And of course, you could argue that the end of Escape to Victory and the end of Rocky are quite similar scenes with the crowd coming on and Stallone looking for his girlfriend at the time that he met on the in Escape to Victory, who he meets, and also Adrienne. Is it Adrienne? Oh, no, Rocky. But the just as one final footnote, and I know we're straying increasingly away from FC Start, but I did read that there was a script had been written 2 or 3 years ago for a remake of Escape to Victory. Now that would be something to watch, wouldn't it? Which actor would you cast in the Michael Caine role?
Couldn't you argue that things like The Mean Machine are kind of remakes of Escape to Victory anyway?
Yes, that's a good thought, actually.
You know, there was the Burt Reynolds one and the Adam Sandler one, and I'm pretty sure and there was a guy, maybe not a Guy Ritchie one, but I'm pretty sure there was one with Jason Statham, Vinnie Jones.
Is this The Longest Yard? Are we talking
that's about? That's it. It was The Longest Yard that had Burt Reynolds in. That's right. It had Burt Reynolds in, and then it was remade of Adam Sandler, but I'm pretty sure there was one called, yeah, it was like The Mean Machine. I'm sure it's Jason Statham as a keeper and Vinnie Jones leading a team. That's the same sort of thing, isn't it? Prisoners versus wardens type sort of game. So I don't know. Does Escape to Victory need to be remade again, or is there enough?
So FC Start, Jamie, how do you rank them?
Well, it's tricky because we don't know too much. There's a lot of myth. There's a lot of folklore. There's a lot of diluted truth in this. So how much we do know is tricky. What I like to think is that in the darkest times, football still found a way. Players who loved the game found a way to play the game and beat their aggressors of that time. And I think for me, that is into the realms of touches of greatness, definitely. But then it inspired the greatest film of all time, Escape to Victory, where we see Michael Caine pausing his football career as Colby before getting back to playing for England and West Ham, and the first American goalkeeper before Brad Friedel and Casey Keller. Yeah, so I think just for those reasons, this is touch of greatness. So that's where I put FC Start.
Mario, can you fight? Well, are you going to argue with any of that?
I think I might, because now it feels like we're rating Escape to Victory rather than FC Start. And FC Start, you know, the more you read about it, did it really happen? Was it propaganda? You know, I've read differing accounts of it that, you know, some of the players were actually in cahoots with the Germans. The Germans didn't take the football that seriously. How much of it has been amped up? And so were they legends? Did it happen? Yes, it inspired Escape to Victory. So I think there's two different – I don't know how to – can I abstain?
Well, I think – I'm going to help you on that. I think – because you make a very, very solid argument. And you are right. The there is uncertainty over exactly what happened. No one fully knows. The story itself is really strong. I think it fits our kind of emergency bucket of not great, but without them, we wouldn't be where we are today. Because less in a what they've achieved for football, but without them, we wouldn't have the film Escape to Victory. Is that too harsh?
I think it's logical.
So they're legends because they inspired the movie. Yeah. Well, even if it's not true or not.
Yeah. If you know, if, on both levels, if we don't 100% know what went on with them. If the story is as it is, they are still legends. They're, you know, I suppose in the annals of football history, have they beaten the best sides in the world, pulling off soldiers from the front line of Germany? I probably shouldn't have phrased it like that.
That's an unfortunate turn of phrase, that.
Pulling soldiers from the front line in Germany onto...
You could have said Goering pulling off soldiers from the front line.
Oh, we're going to be making jokes about dribbling in the box now, aren't we?
Yeah. No. Wouldn't be good. Wouldn't be good. So I think we go as FC start. Oh, it's a long. I'd like putting the phrase in as to what we've judged them at the end, but. We have such a long title for them. FC Start, not great, but without them, we wouldn't be where we are today. And this is our time machine, where we give us the opportunity, our Marty McFly opportunity, to go back. You set your DeLorean, where are you going to set it to? Now, you can go back and watch any of these teams this weekend. Now, I think it's probably pretty clear that for reasons, of multiple reasons, you're not going to choose to go back to the to war-torn Soviet Union to watch FC Start. But, you know, maybe the history side of you decides that is the one. But so I suspect we're looking at the choice of between going back and watching 87 Spurs and the Dutch side of 88. Mario, which one do you want to watch?
Just a quick question on rules. When we go back in time, can we talk to anybody, make any bets?
Yeah.
You know, influence anything? Can I say to David, please, don't play Aussies going to Wembley. Don't do it.
You can't go back and tell a younger Mario, don't put the fiver on the treble. no matter how unlikely it is that we're not going to beat Coventry, don't put the money on the Coventry. Okay. Don't believe it.
I know. I would go back to experience Spurs' nearly run, to see Ozzy and Glenn Hoddle in their pomp, to relive the mullets of Diamond Lights, but also then put a bet on in 4 years' time for Netherlands to win the Euros.
Jamie, what about yourself? Where are you going this weekend?
I think I would travel back and watch Tottenham as well, to be honest. There's a lot in that team that interests me quite a lot. And I like to think that the Netherlands 88, where I would love to see Rinus Michels, you know, in his kind of like later stages of life, capitalizing on all that knowledge and winning a trophy for the Dutch. But I'll be there really for Van Basten and Hullet, and I think there's an opportunity in these future pods where I can use the time machine to go back and see them in for different teams. So I think Tottenham 86-87, though, playing this 4-5-1 formation that you've talked about, Hoddle, Ardiles, Waddle, Steve Hodge, who we didn't even talk about earlier, Gary Mabber and Clive Allen just scoring these goals. I'd want to witness that, I think. And that lovely white kit, which was, you know, to coin it before Roy Hullett said it, it was sexy football in that lovely white kit and short shorts as well, if that's your fancy. So, yeah, for me, I think I'd jump in the time machine with Mario and we'll go back and watch Tottenham and put a few bets on, I think.
I think I did go and watch Tottenham play Oxford that year, where Glenn Hoddle he scores the third goal and he bursts through, and we got Peter Hucker in goal back there, and Hoddle bursts through and he's one-on-one the Hucker, and he just looks a Hucker and he falls over and walks past him. It's sort of the thing of beauty. I was there at the time, and I would very happily go back there as well. So we all find ourselves back in 1987 against all odds. Mario, thank you for your time.
Thank you for the invite.
Jamie, good to hear from you as ever. So we wrap it up there. Please get in touch with any comments you have, any additions and corrections. I'm sure there's plenty of those about any of the teams that we talked about today. And we'd also like to hear from you if you've got any suggestions on other great teams we should cover. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you again next time.